Let me ask a question. How many of all of you have written stuff specifically for the public somewhere, sometime?
The fine public.
Well, general public, apart from not a scientific audience or all, but written something that was specifically designed for, you know, just general readers, not, for you've taken a shot. What did you find to be the critical issue you faced in trying to do it successfully?
Well, I think I've learned a lot from Jackie. Part of it is that it's hard for us to realize how much what we say is true.
That's a good point. I was at a thing once, which, some of you may have heard of this, Miller Institute of the Bay Area, which one of these ones, and there was an astronomer on the program toward the end who was very annoyed at all the biology talks, because he said, this is supposed to be interdisciplinary, all these biologists are getting up talking about all these jargon terms, I'm going to give my talk without jargon. So a couple of us were sitting there, and we started counting as he went, you know, this is like, I don't know, a 20-minute talk.
Right.
We got up to about 30, 35 jargon terms. He gave up counting that after, said, hey, man, you know.
I think a typical public, a typical person who's never lived that experience, remove the jargon every sentence of the beginning.
What you guys said, Joe, about
No, this is for scientific American, so it's a little bit more, it's not the general public.
But it's close, that's
yeah.
Getting there.
Yeah. I don't know, you know, we had an editor who was very active, and I think did a very good job in taking out the bits that shouldn't be there. But in terms of prose, he was basically okay with it. I mean, we were sensitive to the question. I think we were sensitive to, you know, the issue of jargon.
Well, jargon is clearly the key number one probably issue in Deerfield. That's the number one barrier. Certainly not the only issue. There's jargon gets into the realm of specific techniques limited with jargon. This is a little passage, though. Just baseline attitude towards communicating the public. This is Ian Stewart's book from a while back that I thought did a really good job of summing up what communicating with the public about science is all about. You just have to stick down there where he said mathematics, whatever, you can stick science there or whatever, or physics or whatever your particular field is, and get this sense of communicating with the public. It's not just a question of, you know, limiting the jargon, it's a question of really figuring out what to communicate to and what sorts of things get something across. And this thing about, you know, posing it, what you're doing, basically. Tell them what you're doing and why it's important and, you know, what you can do if you achieve what you're trying to do and all those sorts of things. Give a framework. It's just a good baseline way of looking at it. But then I have to do my top 10 list, which then we can talk about some of the specific points individually. I just run through this quickly. First thing I do, most top 10 lists like this about writing clearly and stuff, one of the rules is always supposed to be write like you talk. But with scientists, I've kind of eliminated that. I don't, so that one's not up there. But just realizing to begin with that being clear is more important than being, you know, well, it's more important than being erudite. You know, it's more important than impressing people, it's more important to be clear. Of course, use the jargon. The idea that you have to, giving definitions does not solve the problem. If you use jargon to define it, that's not it. It's describing things to people so they get a grip on what you're talking about. Being concise and short. Another important point is sometimes things, it's perfectly clear, but it's also perfectly dry to communicate more of those images, get the reader engaged. This is just a reminder to people.
Well, utilize is a word that people use.
Yeah, yes. And.
People utilize what?
That's kind of the point, that's the right way to talk, that's the way I kind of get around that when I try to say, don't use you, relating to me, I'm curious. And the last point, some people will say accuracy is not as important as clarity, or they won't say maybe that clearly, but they'll kind of hint at that. I don't really quite agree with that. I think accuracy is important, but using judgment about how accurate you have to be in a given context, it's kind of like, there's always no exceptions or details on things, but if that's what you're writing about, it's important not to gloss over or say correctly. And sometimes there's stuff that comes in from the side that's not the point of what you're writing about that you have to let go. Anyway, my favorite little story about
the top 10, the 10th is the most important, and is there an order here?
Don't know that you could really quantitatively.
They're just thrown together.
I play with the order sometimes, depending on what kind of talk I'm giving and how, you know, points I'm making. I don't think it's clearly the top one is.
One idea per sentence. It's pretty sparse as well.
Yeah.
One idea per paragraph.
No, I've got a good illustration of that. Okay, but no, there's no real order here except for. Perhaps the point that value and clarity to begin with kind of has to be the underlying value that you have. This is my favorite story about Asimov. It's something that he wrote once about when he was just starting out and he was trying to be a writer and he was trying to write the most prolific and beautiful prose that he could come up with. And one of his professors asked him this question. You know how Hemingway says, the sun rose the next morning. No, say that. That was the lesson that set Asimov on the way to being successful in what he was writing, because, you know, writing is not about figuring out some clever way to say something. Writing is about communicating, and that's saying it. So this is another example I've used before of a scientist's attempt to write a title for a paper that was, you know, in plain English. And I thought this was really good. This was from a preprint. And the guy wrote this, and I had read the preprint. It was really very good. And he submitted it to his Red Letters, and the published version came out like this. Now, you know, this is just an example of what I'm talking about is it's getting across. If you're talking to people, I can tell. Now, Fifth Rep Letter people say, well, this is a scientific audience, not the public. I contend still that the first title is a better title, but, you know, it's like they made the guy rewrite in the.
It's a better title, but the second conveys more information to me.
Yeah, it does, but, you know, if the title's good enough, you might read further and get more information to you. I mean, it's...
Well, the second title, I don't need to read the book.
There you go. So if you don't want to get the public to read, then, you know, that's your strategy. That's exactly right. The jargon stuff is...
What about the titles that sometimes people use, which you have? One or, you could have done the book titles with more subtitles.
That could be effective. I would like that. You can turn around, put the technical enforced or sales could add a band. That would be a useful device, okay? Particularly in a certain audience. Yeah, I mean that would be good. I use that technique a lot in writing, where I'll take something like that. Either a title or something a scientist said, or I'll quote from a scientist or something, and actually put it in there and say what he meant was blah 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 blah. And that can, you know, that does some things because it helps people, yeah, see that they can understand that stuff, you know, if it's presented by them. So that can be a good technique. A lot of it is just common sense. A lot of it is just, you know, you can just rewrite it in a way that, the way you would say, or, you know, the way other people would normally talk about it. And it's mainly just a question of pausing to think about it. You know, a lot of times, the stuff that gets written is just your own way of thinking. You put it out there, you don't pause to think about changing it. I went through and picked out a few titles off of Ask Your PH the other day, and just looked to see if there's an example. I mean, yeah, and you're right, though. Sometimes you do lose a little bit of information, but you got to weigh that against getting any information across to begin with. And there are cases where, here's one example. Here's another example. I mean, you sometimes do lose some of it, but if you're in a scientific audience, you can make that judgment. It's probably maybe worth it. But if you're communicating more generally, you've got to do that trade-off calculation. You're going to get a lot more out of it if you do something that loses a little bit, but what is there is easy to take in. So these are just kind of obvious examples. Now, this short sentence stuff. This is a real thing. This was in London, I think, a long time ago. But of course, this concept is, you can't really, since all parties of the first part shall be known in something.
This,
yeah. And this is a clever little bulletin board ad that was saying, insurance companies or whatever don't always have to talk to you and gobble your thing and speak your language. And you can apply this same kind of approach to a lot of scientific stuff. And this is where when I'm trying to explain to people to interns or whatever how to go about taking the stuff that the scientists do and translating it and getting it across in English. The first thing you do is stress this business about, you know, the one idea per sentence or the shorter sentences concept. Now, this is an actual paragraph from a scientific paper. This is several years old, but I think it was Science. This is not the worst writing you'll ever see in a scientific journal by far. And if you read it carefully and closely, you can figure out what they're talking about. But you can make it so much easier. So, like, just for starters, see what I took up there. You know, we've already got talk. We're talking about agreement steroids. You start. Okay, let's see. Take that out. This doesn't lose much. Now, what I'm taking out is a parenthetical additional information part. That now already the sentence is a lot easier to read and grasp to start with. I'll take that part out too. And you still have a sensible sentence. It still makes the main point. You can take that additional information off.
Sure. Was this a news article about a paper?
It's I think it's a review article, probably. I think it's a review article in Science.
Because it depends on the audience.
What happened to the steroid?
That's good. Well, see, we don't need to worry about that yet. this is the point of the sentence. All that other stuff.
I thought it was only in the presence of the steroid.
Yeah. But this was the point. This is the point of the sentence. This is the message. This was the information. And remember, I'm fucking this paragraph out of a big long article. Okay. I mean, we know we're talking about steroids already. But this is we're fucking this paragraph out of this article. This one sentence we're looking at. He gets to this point in the article. He throws in this big long sentence. This is what he wanted to say. This is what he wanted to get across. Now, yeah, I know. I mean. I know that this is perhaps lost some of the information that was in the original sentence.
Yeah, you listen.
Okay. But that's the core of the sentence. Now, if you strip all that out, this is something you can immediately read and take in. Now, it's true that you've left some things out to do this. Well, so what is the solution to that? Is to write some more sentences. The solution is not to cram all that stuff into that one sentence. And this is the key point. Here's, you know, the original sentence. I guess that's the original sentence. Now, the first sentence there is what I cut it down to. And now, these other sentences say what was in the rest of that sentence before. But now, they're just short sentences that make the points individually one at a time, and you can take it in a lot better if you make the points one at a time. So yeah, first of all, you take out the stuff that adds no information, which obviously should be the code. Then you take out the stuff that's additional information, and if what you've taken out, you decide really unique, you write another sentence that added in. But this is the whole concept behind this one idea per sentence point. You take the core idea, get them across one at a time, one sentence at a time, and you've got a lot better chance that they'll take in each individual sentence. Does depend on your audience. It depends on what you're writing, on how familiar it is. Yeah, sometimes you can slip some other simple little thing in if it's not too unfamiliar to people. But the first approach is to get rid of the unnecessary stuff and then separate the points out and put them one at a time. So there's always this temptation people have to add this parenthetical stuff and all that stuff. And it's either important or it's not. And if it's important, it deserves its own sense, and it's not what you're doing. This next point about the jargon is something that even some science writers and people have. And traditionally, I think this is because it gets taught in school this way. You first define your terms, and then you write what you write. And I don't know, in English composition class, I suppose, or philosophy papers, I guess that's a big deal. But it doesn't work very well in science writing, because people, you want to communicate to people in the language they already possess. You do not have the opportunity to teach them a new vocabulary. So, for example, if for some reason you're writing about battery technology or whatever, and you want to tell them about lithium, I mean, you can look up the definition in the dictionary, and you can say that, and, that might mean something or it might not. Or you can come up with some visual descriptive concept to give the reader an idea that they are getting what you're talking about. I mean, it's true. I mean, you maybe don't end up with what would be an exclusive, all-encompassing, perfect definition of lithium, but you don't need that. You just need to give people some idea. A lot of this, and people get mad at me when I say this, a lot of it is tricking people into thinking they understand what you're saying. Okay? Because, I mean, let's face it, especially in a lot of areas of science, you're not going to get somebody who's reading this article in the paper or something cold to really understand general relativity. Okay? I mean, you're not going to get them to really understand any of a number of things. But you can give them the impression that they're understanding something that allows them to go on and read without stopping to say, what's going on?
Okay. Model for earlier public lecture.
Yeah.
I think it's analogous to good Chinese meal.
Yeah.
For an hour or two after you feel like you're kind of full, satiated, and then it falls. Most of it.
Yeah, I would say you'd like for some little remnant memory of how good it tasted to stay with you. But that's exactly right. In most cases of communication, I mean, this is back to this, you're not educating people. You know, you're conveying some ideas and you're giving something across, but you're not teaching vocabulary in science. You're giving some appreciation for what science you're up to, what they're doing, what it's all about. And they are not going to have any need to come back and pass a test defining living incorrectly. They're going to have some desire, though, maybe to say, I heard this neat thing about how they use this neat metal to do this. And the point is all letting them think that they're understanding more than they really are for the purpose of getting some of the idea across. But I do get wiped out by people when I say they're tripping on it. And part of that description thing instead of defining thing is doing things that that evoke images. I mean, this is just a key to good writing generally. It's like making the pictures in people's heads, even if the sentence you've written is perfectly understandable. This is not hard to understand or hard to read. But if you express it more metaphorically, and I think this is just something I grabbed up as an example, this is not necessarily the greatest or best way to say it. The point is just that if you express things metaphorically that evoke images, you keep people going there. Even if it doesn't say anything more, even if it says something that's, some people might not like the way it's said, it certainly gives you a better chance of keeping the people reading because their mind is working, their visual cortex areas are helping them along. And, the first sentence is fine, but it's melancholous and not very visual. Now, y'all have heard of S.I. Hayakawa, right? Remember S.I. Hayakawa, the famous senator who was a semanticist before he was a senator and generally regarded as a better semanticist than a senator? Although a lot of people don't think he was such a hot semanticist either. But nevertheless, he wrote this really famous book, that it must have been originally back maybe the 30s or 40s, called Language and Thought in Action. And for anybody who wants to be a communicator, it was really a good book to read, getting down to the basics of what communication is all about. Really emphasizing the point that communication is all about getting these symbols called words that stand for some things out there. And you want to tell people about the things, but the only way you can do that is by using these symbols that are representatives of the things, not the actual things. That's kind of like math and science in that way. The equations stand for things that you would ideally be the actual representations of something in reality, but they're not really reality. So Hayakawa has a lot of good points and advice about how this is done. And one of his concepts is this concept of the ladder of abstraction. This might be a little hard to see back there, but this is kind of an agricultural metaphorical example. But he says start from the bottom. I think, the concept of wealth is an abstract concept. Asset, such as a business's asset, is a little more specific. Farm asset, specifically an asset, is far more specific. Livestock is a specific kind of farm asset. Cow is an even more concrete representation. And Bessie the cow is a specific concrete representation of what also is in the category of wealth. And down here, you can't see, this is probably too low, he's saying the cow known to science ultimately consists of atoms, electrons, etc., according to present-day scientific inference. So you could get more specific, I suppose. But the point is, two things. One, abstract stuff is harder to get across than concrete stuff. If you're talking in abstractions, that is harder for a reader to get a grip on it and to know exactly what you mean, because an abstract term encompasses so much. Second thing, the concrete terms are much more likely to be visual. And, Bessie the cow, or what's that cow, or some other famous cow?
The Chicago Fire?
No, some advertising cow, somebody
else.
Elsie the cow, yeah, that's it. It immediately evokes a concrete visual representation for people. Well, now here's, and this is a related point, because here's something I often hear scientists write about, they'll say, well, what the electron wants to do is follow this path or something like that. So electrons do not have free will, and electrons don't decide, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, that's just ignoring the whole concept of communication. It's a literary device called personification, okay? It's a real legitimate mode of communication in writing to attribute that kind of human or personal characteristics to an inanimate object for the purpose of making your point, describing what's going on. I mean, in some contexts, I suppose you do have to be careful, because in some contexts, with, you know, maybe some animals or something, there might be an actual issue there about what kind of cognition is going on, you know, in the duck's brain as it's foraging for food or something. But generally speaking, when you're writing that way, it's just a way of making things concrete and visual, and people understand it. I mean, you know, you're not really going to just be confusing people into thinking, you know, some sort of pop. Common particle is certainly flipping it over before it does something. So it's just a technique. Right? So a lot of times you see people writing in this way where they'll use a brand name for something instead of just generic thing. And the whole point there is you're evoking an image, you're being specific, you're getting people to relate to something for the person. It's a more effective way of communicating. This is just an example. This is another, you see this, I think this is from that other paper. You know, talk about rodent, primate, and human findings instead of studies on rats, monkeys, and people. You know, again, it's using a concrete, specific way of talking. Of course, they like to say, you know, the animal model and stuff, instead of saying, you know, slice the rat's brain open because they get upset about that. But, I mean, I guess you should still have some degree of sensitivity. But you hate that when you're reading a paper and you want to write something and there's, you know, they say, and then the animal or the rodent or the pest organism, and what the hell was it? You know? So it's really a question of keeping in mind this being concrete specific. Another thing that I think is really critical is I call it engage the reader. It's kind of like inviting people to read. It's like when the point about putting that those two titles together where you have the fun one and the technical one and the fun one. The good thing about the fun one is it gives the potential reader the idea that this might be fun. You know, it might be interesting to read it. It might be possible to read it and understand it. So you want to signal people right off the bat that the way you're going to communicate to them is going to be friendly. And so I picked out some of my favorite examples that I've done over the years of putting things in a way that suggested to people that it was going to be friendly. Now, some of this is, sometimes it's kind of dumb, but it's a trick. It's one of those tricks. It's one of those techniques that you can go where you want to go, you know. You can take them where you want to take them once you've invited them in with something that's telling them that you know, this is not science class today. This is gonna be something fun to do. So, I mean, it's a challenge sometimes to come up with a way to represent some topics, but it really, really makes a big difference in getting people to want to find out more. You want to get them to want to find out more and let them know that it's going to be not too painful. Now, you know, sometimes I've been accused of making it sound like it's going to be less painful than it really is once they get into it, but nevertheless, you get them into it and you try to get them into it in a way that is inviting. So, again, this is a thing where scientists have a problem. A lot of scientists have a problem allowing themselves to do this sort of thing because they think they'll be criticized, and often they are criticized by the legal scientists who don't want people to communicate well. And, you know, that's not good. That's one of the big issues is, I just need to loosen up a little and let people have some fun. But that's, you know, just part of that underlying philosophical approach to doing that you need to do. So these are just, you know, old examples that I've used. And anyway, the point about accuracy that I made a little bit at the beginning is I still maintain that you should really always try to be accurate, and the statements you make really are actually true. Now, but you got to use judgment. Part of that judgment is understanding the concept of metaphor, making it metaphorical does not make it inaccurate. It's not really a cloud. A cloud is only a thing up there in paper in the sky. That's not inaccurate. That's metaphor. That's okay. And personification is a literary technique. It's okay. It doesn't make it inaccurate. If what you're saying is happening, is happening. It's a manner of description. So, you've got to understand that. And then you've got to understand context, because in some contexts, something may not be strictly true 100% of the time, but it's not what you worry about now. There's a lot of stuff, especially in sciences like anthropology and even like evolutionary biology and stuff. There's a lot of stuff that's basically pretty much the case, even though you can find here this one example that's an outlier but in science like that, you don't attempt to account for every last individual outlying case. You want to, as Stephen Jay Gould calls, dominant relative frequency is the key issue. So you can't always bring in every last little qualifier in consideration. If you're talking about, say, neuroscience, for example, and you're writing about some things that to do with neuroscience, and you say, well, okay, brain cells communicate by sending little molecules across little gaps between these arms of the nerve cell. All right. Somebody's going to say, well, what about gap junctions where there's direct contact with electrical communication? You can't just say that it's just this. Well, if what you're writing about is specifically about the mechanisms of cell communication, blah, 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 and it's something where gap junctions come into play, then that's right. Then you can't leave out gap junctions. But if you're writing about some other area of neuroscience, and just peripherally it comes in that there's neurotransmitters crossing synapses is how they communicate, then it's not a crime not to also say, well, there are also cases where there's gap junctions. That's beside the point. That's not what you're writing about. So this is about using the judgment and understanding the context in which you're communicating. So, that does get to be a judgment area sometimes. But understanding things well enough to use the right qualifying terms. Lots of times you just need to throw in a qualifying term. And you have to know enough to know whether the qualifying term needs to be never or almost never or usually or almost always and those sorts of things. But leaving it qualified like that and not going into the details, except when it's pertinent to the context, is kind of a critical thing about it. So, those are the kinds of things that I think are the key things. And yet, the trick, of course, is there's a whole lot of things there that when you're writing this and doing this, you kind of have to keep all those in mind all at once. That's what I think the challenge is. Because lots of times, you see somebody does good at one area, but not some of the other areas, and it's a start, but it doesn't have the overall total polish it needs to be really successful. So, does anybody have any observations? Comments, criticisms? What did y'all think of Carl Sagan? Somebody missed that.
Cheers.
He's mostly oral.
Well, he books. Well, you wrote Pulitzer Prize winning books.
Well, he won his title.
Carl Sagan
understood most of these things, probably maybe just intrinsically or something, but he understood most of these things the way he communicated. You know, he got a lot of grief for communicating. Of course, now, there's also people who have told me things about Carl Sagan, you know, sometimes he could be something of a jerk. And that contributed probably to his problem. But I think there's a really big need to separate, you know, the person's individual possible personality foibles from the communicating to the public that they do. You know, I mean, whether somebody's a jerk or not, if they do a good job communicating to the public, that's, you know, a good thing to do. And you don't want to, you know, trash somebody because for the wrong reasons, you know. But, you know, I think he was an example of somebody who did a lot of good for science by, you know, effectively communicating, and whatever, you know, anybody thought of otherwise, it's beside the point. It's something that was a valuable thing to be done. But do you think there's still a lot of pressure against people communicating for it?
A lot of what?
Pressure against scientists to want to go out and communicate around?
I don't know. It's complicated. Sometimes they want to be doing successfully. Feel pressure against, and it's not fair. Whether it's they don't communicate, they wouldn't feel the same.
It's not clear what?
They wouldn't feel the same if they weren't communicating at all. There's probably some. I think it was less than it was in the common person. Carl Sagan was early, and the last communicator in the university. And as a scientist, he wasn't either.
He wasn't. I didn't hear you.
I don't think he was either regarded. He was sort of And I think part of the resentment was probably in a sense because he gave those very, he had a sort of highfalutin air about him, to some extent, that was talking about very profound things, doing it very well, as you say. Some of the resentment was that.
Yeah, there was clearly.
Came off as a profound thing.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. There's clearly some resentment out there.
But someone like, I don't think Brian Greene, for example, has books about profound things. It's come off as like a certain resentment.
Yeah. Sarah, I'm not sure.
And it's a big, and it's probably a different style. I mean, you're always in that realm, you suffer. You expose yourself to it, especially in a visual media. And your personality gets before.
Yeah, that's part of it. Sarah, would you answer something?
To do what you're doing, talking about to do it well, verbally or in writing, takes time. It's a choice of time. It does take time to craft it well. And that's a choice away from building a resume, and people under tremendous pressure to have peer-reviewed talks and papers. And so those things count for nothing when people are focused on that side of their work. So that's another pressure that's very hard to fight.
I think that's a good point. It is hard to do. It is time-consuming. And science, for best science, sort of time is being consumed trying to do the science, and that's one of the real problems and pressures. But on the other hand, I think a lot of scientists do realize there does need to be some effort to make some time for it. But it is hard to do. That's something a lot of people don't appreciate. It's not just simple to make this stuff come across so it's clear, it's difficult. Especially difficult to make it clear, and also to still be right. What's the, you know, shortcut some science writers make is they write it very clearly, but they don't put that much effort into knowing what they're talking about. They just want to write nice, good-sounding stuff, and get a little ammo in it, and make it sound right, and they don't really succeed in really getting to the depths of what they're saying.
How much do you value the penetration of your audience?
Which do I feel that?
How about, so there's the statement that every time you put in an equation, you half your audience. So what do you think the ratio is? Yeah. Two, more than two, less than two?
Well, I think it depends on where you're doing this. I mean, that's what they say. You know, if you put an equation in a book, it halves the sales. Well, I don't think that. I think that's just more like a warning rather than a precise estimate. I mean, clearly there are some books with some equations in it that do pretty well. The rest, it's what's around the equation. I mean, if you flip open the book and you see equations, yeah, I think that really cuts your chances of selling people to the general public. If there's one or two notes, maybe a footnote, that's not a problem. What's most important is what surrounds the equation and how you get there and what you say about the equation. I mean, people who buy popular science books are actually pretty interested in getting some substance out of the book.
I mean, it makes them feel good, right? If they read the equation and, like, you lead them, right? Spend a lot of pages, and then comes the equation,
right?
And they feel that they understand the equation.
Right. Yes,
and that's more appealing than not staying.
Yeah, and I think for a large segment of the readership, that's true. If you tell them what it means and show how they can understand the equation, that's good. It's particularly true in books that, obviously math books or physics books, too, and a lot of that sort of thing. If you overwhelm them with equations, it's bad. If you choose very carefully the right equation, it gives them a sense that they've understood a little bit more. And so I think most publishers recognize that the rule is not you can't have a single equation. The rule is you shouldn't open a page at random and see an equation. That would be bad.
But I'm not even responding.
Most of the time, you're better off trying to write what you're saying in English and use some visual and metaphorical and comparative terms. I mean, maybe you put the exponent in the footnote or something, but it's certainly a lot better to say a trillion trillion than 10 to the 24. Okay? I mean, in general, in writing for the public. Now, if you want to say what 10 to the 24 is, sometimes you put a footnote or something, that's okay. But just the general realm of the narrative and what you're writing, you convert it into ordinary English whenever you can in any reasonable way. And then give some example that conveys what that magnitude is like. I mean, there's lots of good examples to try to convey, you know, how big a superstring scale is by, you know, comparing peanut to the universe and superstring to an atom or whatever.
People don't know how big the universe is. People don't know how big the universe is.
Well,
I guess it's scary.
But they know it's really big. And so you might can calculate out some actual correct ratio, but they don't need to know the exact ratio. If you can tell them that something's, this is something compared to something that they know is really, really big, they get the idea.
Well, I guess it depends on the audience you're reaching for. Because you take Brown Weiss's book, Subtle as the Lord, right? It's hard to believe that would have been a bestseller, right? But it was very popular.
Yeah.
And he tried to write it in a way that a person who didn't know math could read certain sections.
Right. Well, and of course, he had a good topic. You know, and he had a good person to write about that drew people in. Penrose's book, so especially, you know, that first one that made the big splash on The Emperor's New Mind, where he had equations all through that book, and it sold very, really well. He somehow got a remark going on that. Now, don't get me into what I thought of it, because it was one of those great great cases where he wrote about all these different areas that somebody didn't know about in the other area, and so the people who knew about the area thought he knew what he was talking about in the other areas. In each individual area, they knew he wouldn't. But it's like, but still, I mean, there are examples of books like that where people have these equations and they've done them pretty well. There's an audience out there for that. Now, whether these people just buy the book and show it off or actually read it, I'm not so sure. But there is an audience out there for that. But that's different, that's a little different from the general public in general. So if you're talking about writing a popular book, okay, you know, a popular book might sell a loser popular book will sell a few thousand, you might get up to 10,000, and they'll let you write another book. If you sell 50,000, you're doing pretty good, and then you get up to higher than that, and you're really doing good. But that's, you know, 100,000 books, selling 100,000 books is a great book sale. But I mean, if you're writing for a daily newspaper, you know, there's five times that number of people looking at the paper each day. And so you're not reaching mass general public. I mean, you're reaching a daily newspaper, you reach 500,000 people in one city. If you're writing a popular book, you might reach, you know, a tenth of that in the whole country. So it's not the same audience. It's not the whole general public audience.
That half a million people, less than just
reading
the sports page.
No, less than half read the sports page.
That's the man.
No, but for every man, there are a lot of women who read the sports page, but for every woman who does, there's a man who doesn't. So it's, you know, it's half or a little less than half. I mean, there's certainly not. It's not a woman.
Oh, he used to write the science stuff for the paper. I mean, he just didn't know that.
Well, the surveys that were done, okay, so the paper circulation, although they lied about the circulation, so this is a little bit inaccurate, they're probably all going to go to jail, which would be really good. the circulation was on the order of 500,000. I mean, it's probably, at one point, probably was that, and then and then there's the multiplier, and the surveys would indicate that on average two people look at each paper, or 1.9 or something like that. So generally speaking, on any given day, a million people have the paper in their hands. So in our surveys would show that for the science stuff, especially when we had a real science section on the day we had a real science section, that probably half, that's, you know, 47% would look at that section, and probably half of them would actually read some stuff in it. So you're talking about, you know, half a million people who would look at it, and half of those are 250,000 who would actually read something in there. Okay, you know, that's pretty good. Now, you know, a lot of these 250,000 are not reading every word and not studying it, but they're getting exposed to it. And so, and then there's a certain number of people who do read it too. So, I mean, but in any case, you have a pretty large audience that you're exposing to this stuff and communicating to, very diverse audience. You know, people would ask me, okay, what audience are you writing for? Who are you reaching? And it was clear to me over the years, you're getting enough feedback to get a sense of that. And one, there are several big segments in the audience. One big segment is, in fact, the more technically trained people. In a city like Dallas, you got a huge medical community, you got a huge high-tech, Texas Instruments, stuff like that community. You got, you know, university communities, you got, you know, hospitals, nurses. Nurses are big readers of this stuff. You know, people don't think about people like that, but they really do. That's one whole big area. People who are technically, scientifically trained and are interested in this stuff outside of the field. Another big segment was the stay-at-home type people. You know, the people who, you know, housewives, house husbands, retirees, whatever. People who were at home, and they read the whole paper. People who got the paper, and they had time to go through it, and they get to the science stuff and really liked it. Not technically trained at all, necessarily, or not really, you know, technically knowledgeable, but really eager to get something other than war and crime and politics to read about. So you got a big audience like that. People have time to read the paper, they like that stuff. And then the third big group was the kids. because, and partly because the science teachers would force kids at that point to read the science section in the newspaper, but partly because, you know, the kids, if they got exposed to the paper, this was a lot more interesting to them than the climate topics too. So you get a real diversity there of who you're running for, because you're running for some people who are knowledgeable in certain areas and some people who are not knowledgeable but highly interested. And so you got to communicate these people in a way to get substance across the board without, you know, relying on any previous knowledge, but still giving something to people who have some previous knowledge. So, but it is a hard job, and making the effort, but people who make, it's really important for people to make the effort.
But isn't it safe to say that there are actually quite a lot of people who should not be writing books?
Yes, and unfortunately, most of them are the ones who are writing books.
Yeah. Okay. So what is better, a journalist or a scientist? Do you have more faith?
I was on a panel once. The best thing was it was on C-SPAN. This guy who wrote A Scientist, what's his name? Cell or something like
that.
Yeah. Anyway, he writes, anybody friends of him who's in here? Anyway, he's written a number of science books, scientists, and he was on his panel and said, well, I believe that only scientists should write science books, because only scientists know enough about the reality of science. It's like, you know, it's like getting, only, you know, soldiers should write about the world, because that's the only real knowledge. But, yeah, so, but fortunately, there was enough time left for me to get the microphone. I've never heard anybody say such nonsense in my life. I mean, it's fine for some scientists to write books, because some scientists, they are knowledgeable and they do write well and they do great, and that's great. But to say only scientists should write books is nonsense. I mean, journalists, if a journalist, if a science journalist writes a crummy book, it's because they're a crummy journalist, not because, you know, they aren't trained as a scientist. Problem is, a lot of scientists, you know, a scientist who writes about his or her own work is great. But as soon as a scientist writes, steps a step outside their own specialty, they're just being journalists and probably aren't very well trained to do it. And so then, if you're writing a popular book, you're almost always going to be writing stuff and it's not just your own work. And then it's the same thing. But I've trained a lot of journalists in Dallas who come through who were actually science, the AAAS mass media program, you know, and they would put people who were generally just got their PhD or were close to it, and they would come to a summer for a media site and learn about media. Most of them were actually not that bad as writers. Most of them, if they got that program to begin with, they had some basic writing skill and they could put sentences together pretty well. And that, you know, that wasn't the hard part. But most of them were very poor on the accuracy scale. Because you give them a story to do that was not in their field, and they write stuff they think they know stuff, and you know, they would make horrible scientific errors. And you know, it's like, it's because they did not grasp the journalistic skills you need to have to figure out how to get things right and all the way things can go wrong. And you know, they write something in that they, you know, in their freshman year, they're taking a biology class or something, and they write that into their story like it was true. It was probably wrong when they learned it, but even if it was right then, it might not be right now. And that's the sort of thing that they didn't get. So, yeah, there were successes. Some of them were real good.
Some of the best writers go talking about real style. You can read some of their prose notes down.
Mm-hmm.
And most scientists don't. I mean, our writing is almost a little bit style free. I mean, is that something one can learn? Some of the styles like incorporated into your list, but some, I don't know, that's just...
Is that something you can learn?
Well, if you're writing that.
I think some people can learn and some people can't. So, I mean, I don't know of a good test to write with style, to write with a personal style. Instead of writing the homogenized, you know, sanitized, straightforward style, grammatical style. I don't know, I can identify, I sometimes can identify people, like when I go through applications for these media fellowship things and by interns, sometimes you can spot somebody who had that somewhere in there that you get out and make it come back. But I'm pretty sure some people can't. I mean, it would be kind of like, you know, calculus, I guess. I mean, it's like, if somebody had some basic skills, I think it could be taught. I think if we had some, I think I could get it out of some people and get them to, and I've had a few people come through who come out with this style that's fully theirs, that they had no inklings of the ability to do it, but I showed them how to do it. So I mean, it can be done if you have some baseline, basic facilities.
The same is true of the time, just popular with
oh, yeah.
Scientists have personalities.
Yeah.
Certainly recognize certain people, yes. And some people are unrecognizable.
If you've got a good personality, you can get it to come out, I think. It's part of the sis, part of the sky. You know, some of that stuff I talk about, having the right to engage people. That's kind of like putting personality in the writing, making it personal. And you do it in your way, and you have your... It's kind of like... pausing to think about it.
Well, to some extent, teaching helps.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, but there's successful teachers. You see, have that personal style in lecturing or in the classroom that they use to get things across, that you can translate that in some ways. It's definitely something that takes some basic grasp of. But, you know, a lot of it is tricky. A lot of this trickery too. There are some people who are just literarily gifted, you know. Now, I'd say Casey Cole is literarily gifted. She can write this stuff, but and I get sick of my wife when she reads Casey Cole stuff. So she's a lot better than you. But, and I'm not literarily gifted. Okay, clearly, I'm not. I mean, then a lot of people would second that. But I get away with a lot of trickery and tricking people to think it's pretty good because of some of these techniques that you can learn that, you know, make it more personal and more personal style and more colloquial. And it, you know, it's not going to knock any literary critic's socks off, but it's going to be, it's like the Asimov thing. It's going to be clear and it's going to get stuff across and it's going to engage people. And that's you know, what I'm trying to do. It's like, you know, I'm not trying to shoot for some unattainable literary goal that it's best not for somebody who's got a shot at it. I'm trying to trick people into thinking a little bit
more. What did you think of Lewis Thompson?
Too gloomy.
Didn't like it.
I understood why people liked it. He was engaging in his way, but it wasn't to my taste. I mean, I'm not, which is not the same as saying it was bad, but I thought he was a little, you know, too flowery, too wordy, too verbose sometimes, and it was not bad. I mean, it appealed to some people and engaged some people. It's just my feeling, my taste is more toward punching out the sense. You know, I'm not trying to. Yeah. I mean, I want to take somebody that's like, you know, reading what I write should be like kicking them in the face, you know, and they're getting jolted and they're getting, you know, something's getting through to them.
Have you read Einstein?
Einstein? Oh, yeah. Well, it's hard to tell because, you know.
Oh, it's translated.
It's translated. It's translated. Yeah, right. And
he was probably, in my opinion, one of the greatest.
Well, his papers, especially his early papers, you know, even in translation, you can see how he was getting the clear ideas across it. You know, talking about, you know, looking at your watch and the trains here, and he was very good at grabbing these central points and putting them out clearly. Now, Stephen Jay Gould, on the other hand, was real verbose. But very engaging as well. And his style is not a style I would try to write, but I read a lot of his stuff and it was engaging. And he could bring you along and stuff, even stuff I didn't have a particular interest in to begin with. He could carry me along with the way he did it. It was very different.
Right. very different.
Right, very, very different. I mean, Stephen Jay Gould, the ideas kind of got there eventually, if you kept going, you found yourself kind of without realizing this idea had come through and gotten it. And instead of the way I believe, I came with the idea right off the bat. But there's different ways, of course, so that's not...
Regiment with a B?
No, that would be an England. A British spelling would have an E, not an American.
America, yeah.
British. Anyway. Thank you all for coming.
Cookies.
Next Friday, I believe we'll have Charles Pettit.
Oh, yeah.
He will be here and sitting in on the talk. He's got just...
Sitting in or talking?
Well, can we discuss it? He's going to sit in and join the discussion. He used to be at U.S. News and World Report, and before that, San Francisco Chronicle, and he's been writing lately for National Geographic and Smithsonian and stuff. So he'll be a little bit of person to have people come and chat with. So thanks for coming.